Hello, I'm Lee Gatiss, the editor of The Theologian at www.theologian.org.uk, the internet journal for integrated theology. I'm joined today by Dr. Peter Adam, the principal of Ridley Theological College in Melbourne, Australia. Peter was born in Melbourne, trained for the ministry in Melbourne, and was ordained, well, I won't tell you when, but it was a few years ago. After a few curacies, he studied in London and Durham universities, graduating with a master's degree in New Testament and a PhD in systematic theology. He also lectured at St. John's College in Durham in the 70s and 80s. Peter was a minister at St. Jude's Carlton in Melbourne for about 20 years. He's published three books to date: The Majestic Son, a commentary on Hebrews; Speaking God's Words, a practical theology of preaching; and Hearing God's Words, a book on biblical spirituality, as well as numerous articles and booklets on historical and practical subjects. He is therefore an integrated theologian and a perfect person for us to interview on The Theologian. It's great to have you, Peter. Thank you. So, Peter, tell us, I was going to ask you how you became a Christian, but you told me you've got a funny story about your birth. So tell us about your birth.
Yes,
and your new birth.
And my new birth, that's great. Well, my parents had two boys, and then my father went off to fight in the Second World War in Egypt and then New Guinea. He came home, and my mother didn't recognize him because he was so damaged by illness and so on. Anyway, I was born a little over 9 months later. We were all caesareans because my mother was a very small woman. And in those days, you'd only have three caesareans, you see. So I was the last child, and my mother desperately wanted a little girl.
Oh.
So the story is the nurse woke her up and said, "Mrs. Adam, you've got a lovely little blue-eyed boy." My mother said, "Another bloody boy." Which is great fun, because my mother was a very loving person, never swore, and treated me with great affection. So we used to joke about that every birthday, as a matter of fact. Another bloody boy.
She wasn't too disappointed how you turned out.
No, hopefully. It was all right. It was all right, yeah.
And your new birth, when did that happen?
Yeah, well, my parents weren't Christians. We used to go to church occasionally, Christmas and Easter, that kind of thing. They were very good people, but they weren't Christians. When I was at school, there was a teacher, form teacher, whom I didn't like at all. He was a real dope. And he wasn't a Christian, but his father had been a Christian, actually a minister. And when he talked about his father and his father's values, and with some nostalgia, actually, I thought, whatever his father had, I want. So he wasn't a Christian, but his father had been a Christian. And what he communicated of his father's Christian life, I thought, that's pretty good. I want that. And so powerful was that feeling that I went home and said I wanted to start going to church. So this really spoiled Sundays for my dear father, who very kindly agreed to take me to church for a few years. Unfortunately, the church we went to was not a church in which there was any Bible teaching. It was a very liberal Presbyterian church. I then moved on to an Anglican church where a friend of mine was going, and I became a very loyal Anglican server and sang in the choir and played the piano for Sunday school, did all that kind of thing. But still not any clear gospel teaching. My brother went off to medical school. We took him into the college he's going to stay in. I opened the door, and he's going to share the room with a theological student whom we didn't know and he didn't know. This fellow, I don't know his name, was sitting on his bed reading his Bible. He was a country boy, feeling very lonely and reading the Bible.
Good man.
Good man. And I'd never realized that you could read the Bible on your own rather than in having it read to you by the minister. So I went home and started reading the Bible and became a very enthusiastic Bible reader, though still not converted. I became a very moral person, at least tried to. In fact, my nickname at school, ironically enough, was Puri for puritanical, because I used to refuse to laugh at dirty jokes, which took some determination in our school. So there I was, going to church, reading the Bible, trying to lead a moral life, but nowhere near God, actually. And then I was an organist, filling in at a church while the organist was away. There was a visiting minister filling in because the minister was away the same Sunday by accident. And the visiting minister was a great personal evangelist of the old school. He'd been a missionary in India, come home through ill health, and spent his time converting young men.
Like you.
Like me.
What was his name?
Harry Scott Simmons, that's right. He'd worked with Amy Carmichael at Donavore, and then had been a chaplain at Lavlor Hospital, and also a chaplain at Hebron School. So that was on a Sunday. On the Tuesday, he invited me around to his house. We lived in the same area. He promised to play some Bach on his radio player, because we both like music. But the record player wasn't put on, the Bible was open, and I was converted in 20 minutes. It was amazing, because all of a sudden, all that I'd read from the Bible began to make sense. And even more amazing, I think, is that having converted me, he then met with me every Tuesday for 3 years to disciple me and teach me how to pray, how to read the Bible, how to live the Christian life, and how to witness to my friends about the Lord Jesus.
It's a terrific story.
It's an amazing story, because I've gone back through my family and I can't find many Christians, if any. So I kind of wonder why I'm a believer, actually. Yeah.
Maybe one of them was praying for you all
that
time.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Clearly the Bible's quite important in your story there, reading the Bible for yourself and having it explained and opened. One of your books is called Hearing God's Words on the Bible. But we have an archbishop in this country, you may know about him, who says that, and I quote, he speaks of God as a spastic child who can communicate nothing but his own presence and inarticulate wanting. How do we come to a situation like that, where a main church leader can speak like this? And why do our intellectual elite say that kind of thing and believe that sort of thing?
Yes, I think it's quite amazing, particularly if you look at the ordination promises people make, and the fact they receive a Bible at their ordination. I think it's an extraordinary thing to say. There's a lot of background to it, I think. Rowan Williams has done a lot of work in the history of Christian spirituality over the last 2,000 years, and his book The Wound of Knowledge is a study of that. And part of the Catholic tradition of spirituality is the idea that we may begin ascending to God with words, but the experience of God at the end is a wordless experience. It's a similar idea to the fact that we may begin ascending to God by being aware of our surroundings, but ultimately, if we're going to perceive God, have a direct experience of God, then we will leave this world behind. There are similar kinds of ideas. And so that's, I think he's picked that up from the Catholic spirituality. It's a very common theme. And it is the idea that God is infinite and we are finite. So if we're going to experience God, that must be in an infinite way, not a finite way. Words are finite, and therefore they're not part of that experience. The second ingredient, I suspect, is that the Oxford movement of the 19th century, the High Church movement of the Church of England, was very much affected by the Romantic movement. And one of the ideals of the Romantic movement is that words may point towards an experience, but experience is always deeper than words. So, for example, in music, Mendelssohn wrote his Songs Without Words with the idea that songs that didn't have words had a deeper meaning and a wider meaning, if you like, than songs that did have words. They weren't restricted by the particular words. They were songs which expressed something deeper than words. So the Neoplatonic spirituality movement, I think the Romantic movement, I suspect it also reflects some philosophical ideas. Schopenhauer particularly was influential in that the important things in the universe are beyond words. And also, it may also reflect, I'm not sure about this, the postmodern distrust of words today, or a philosophical distrust, postmodern distrust of the use of words. Now, there is something right about it, that is, God is more than words, and any words about God don't control God or restrict God or completely describe God. But I think the Bible makes it clear that God has taken the initiative in speaking in a human language. The Archbishop is quite right. If God hadn't used human language, then it'd be quite ridiculous for us to use any words about God. We wouldn't know what the right words were. But I guess in the 19th century, generally speaking, this is broadly speaking, the church leaders, liberal church leaders, often lost the confidence that God had spoken in human words, so therefore the Bible is like any other book. You read it like an ordinary book, not a God-given book. And the next stage of that, if you like, is the late 20th century move to say that if God hasn't used human words, then human words are plainly inadequate. Now, interestingly enough, and I don't know if this is true of Rowan Williams, but the charismatic movement has in some parts a similar theory, despite the fact that charismatic movement is most popular, I guess, for its prodigious use of words. One theory in charismatic theology is that the final experience is the worship experience of God, and that is beyond words. It's a wordless experience. And that's why speaking in tongues becomes appropriate, because these are non-cognitive, non-communicative words which describe something beyond words. And, of course, the phrase is often used from Romans 8, the Spirit sigh with sighs too deep for words. So, curiously enough, there's a coming together of the experiential ideals of the Catholic spirituality and charismatic spirituality, which make the wordless thing quite attractive for us today. Now, I have some sympathy for it in that I think we live in an over-worded universe, and indeed we're contributing to that even at the very moment. And I think in the Bible we're encouraged to meditate on the works of God as well as the words of God.
You're thinking Psalm 19.
That's exactly right. Psalms tell you how to meditate. They don't say empty your mind of everything, nor do they say empty your mind of words or of the works of God. They say look at the words of God, meditate on them, and look at the works of God in the world around you and meditate on them. That will fill you with a sense of the glory of God. Yeah.
So you have some sympathy with an anti-word theology to some extent, but it's clearly wrong in other ways.
It's fundamentally wrong.
Yeah.
That's right. I think I love walking by the beach with nobody, enjoying the world around me and seeing the glory of God. I must confess I always think of the words from Job, when God says to the waves, thus far should you go and no further. I mean, I think that's wonderful. It does see the power of God. So I enjoy that a great deal, and I enjoy music without words a great deal. I'm a musician and I love music. But the fundamental question is a theological question, and that is, has God used words to communicate who he is? The answer is he has. And I believe when the Bible says God is love, then that's saying something true about God. God is light, that's something true about God. It's not all can be said about God, but when we meet God face to face, we won't find those words are untrue. We'll find them more truly fulfilled when we meet God and see God face to face.
You think this has infected Christianity through the charismatic movements and through some sorts of forms of Catholicism, Anglo-Catholicism?
Yeah.
Does it have any impact on a sort of evangelical spirituality? Is there some way in which this has affected us as well as conservative evangelicals and reformed Christians in the 21st century?
I guess it has. I know that I find it very hard to sing some of the words of songs that we've picked up. Words could not tell, not even in part, the debt that is owed by my something or other heart, whatever it is.
Heart, yes.
And I think, well, it doesn't matter, but it's actually not true, because words can tell how much we owe God, and that is God tells us, love God with heart, mind, as Jesus put it, heart, mind, soul, and strength. That's how much we have to love God. So there is a distrust of words, which I think is unhelpful. But then I think that on the other hand, we do actually fill our life with too many words, and I find that a bit boring in the long term, to be honest. Yeah.
Well, this is far from boring so far.
No, indeed, we're doing quite well. That's quite right.
We're here to catch you during the EMA, the Evangelical Ministers Assembly here in London, and we heard yesterday morning Christopher Ash from the Cornhill Training Course expanding Psalm 119 and asking how a Christian can delight in God's law, the Old Testament law. Yeah. With many Christians now doubting that the Old Testament law is relevant to us under the New Covenant. Do you think there is a place for the Ten Commandments in Christian living and that sort of thing?
Yes, there's big debate about that, I think, among contemporary Christians. And I guess there's a strong move, certainly we meet it in Australia, for people to say, well, we live by faith and by grace, and so therefore the law has done its job. We know we're sinners, we've turned to Christ, therefore the law has no continuing function for the believer. I find that hard to believe, I guess, because for many years in the Old Communion Service, we used to read the Ten Commandments and ask God to help us incline our hearts to keep this law. Mm. So my natural assumption, I guess, has been the law has some purpose for us. And I don't think that faith and grace preclude obedience. So I don't think that to live by faith and by grace means we don't have to think in the category of obedience, because indeed Paul uses that luminous phrase, the obedience of faith, talking about the significance of the gospel. So faith is obedience, and the true obedience, I think, is faith. And I do find, of course, that Paul actually quotes the law, both in terms of love, the fulfillment of the law, also, for example, the law that children should honour their father and their mother, that this is the first command with a promise, quotes that in Ephesians. And so it seems to me that Paul is quite happy to quote an Old Testament law and assume that New Testament children should honour their father and mother because that's what the law says. Mm. So I'm not quite sure why people regard it as such a dangerous thing to do. The danger with keeping the law is we may think we're trusting our own achievement, but I think that the law not only should direct our behaviour, but also, of course, continues to point out to us the way in which we fail to obey God. Of course, when we talk about obeying the law, we have to then make a distinction about what laws we obey. Mm. Calvin's distinction, I think, was the sacrificial law, the civil law, and the moral law. I don't think that division is within the Bible itself put so clearly, but you can deduce it from the Bible. I think the ceremonial law is clearly fulfilled in the sacrifice of Christ. The national law, the civil law, I think, doesn't apply because we are not a nation as well as a church. We're a church, not a nation. So we're left with the moral law, and I think we should work out how to put into practice that moral law. I think that's a useful thing for us to do. And Paul does speak in positive terms of the law in Romans. The practice of the Bible is to quote Old Testament laws, including love your neighbour. So I'm very happy to keep loving the law of God while recognising how far short of it I fall all the time.
Some would say that take a sort of minimalist position on that and say if the New Testament quotes an Old Testament law, then we can obey
it
too.
Yeah.
Do you think that's too minimalist? Does that leave whole swathes of the Old Testament that we don't obey?
Or? Yeah. I'd be happy with that minimalist solution. I think it has the advantage of clarity. You know where you are. Mm. Of course, then you can look at the Old Testament law and see, well, various parts of the law explain what it is to love your neighbour. So putting a parapet around your roof to stop people falling off is a very practical expression of love your neighbour. Mm. Now, the fact we don't have flat roofs, at least where I live, and so that isn't appropriate. It means I should think of other ways in which I should be careful of my neighbour. So I love the fact that our councils are tough on building regulations about the safety of buildings.
Yes.
Every time a building falls down in Asia, just north of us, I think, thank God for building regulations. They're God's good plan they're not given by God directly, but they're an expression of a right protection of our neighbour, which is a godly thing to do.
Mm. Yeah. So the law, in a sense, unpacks what it means to love our neighbour and to love God, and it's sort of a case law in that culture that we may apply differently.
That's right. Yeah.
It gives us an illustration and an application
times. And that's Jesus' summary of the law, is love God, love your neighbour, and I think that's a very helpful category in which to think.
If we were to take a position which said that the law wasn't of relevance now, where would that put us as Christians? What would be the long-term effects of that sort of teaching?
Well, I think perhaps another way to put the same question with the same effect is to say, what's the long-term effect of rejoicing in our salvation by grace and luxuriating in that and not thinking about our responsibilities of changing the way we live? So what's the effect of thinking about the gospel as grace and not about God's plan to change us? In traditional Christian theology, they're not, I think, the language of the New Testament. What's the effect of focusing on justification and forgetting about sanctification? Mm. Well, the result of that is, I think, long-term cynicism, actually, because people find their lives are not changing. They're always finding God to be their saviour, but not seeing that salvation achieving any transformation of character. And Paul moves to transformation of character very quickly in Romans 6, actually. The moment he says, die to sin and live to righteousness, that is, die to sin by the power of Christ's death, live to righteousness by the power of Christ's resurrection, that's talking about moral transformation, or what we call in theology sanctification, and he expects it very, very soon. Or the fruit of the Spirit and putting, you know, to death the deeds of the body and so on, all of that is talking about a radical transformation of character. Now, churches which focus on that and not on justification give Christians a lack of assurance that they're saved.
Yes.
But churches which focus on you're accepted and nothing's going to happen to you, I think eventually make Christians cynical about God because nothing changes.
And cynicism leads to more license and immorality.
I think it can. I think it can, yes, that's right. Yeah, and no expectation of people changing.
And probably, thinking about what we were speaking of earlier, into forms of charismatic or Catholic worship where they seek some kind of experience like they had at their conversion, because nothing's happened to them since.
Nothing's happened since, yes. That certainly could happen. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the dangers there is people often say in Melbourne, you know, evangelical religion is a great place to start. Mm. But then for maturity, you need either to become a liberal or a Catholic, or a charismatic. This is the great second stage. And I think those are very unhelpful moves.
Yeah. One of the things, the issues on when we talk about the law and all those sort of issues, is the Sabbath. Difficult to classify the Sabbath into a moral, civil, or a ceremonial
exactly
law. It
right.
could be all of them.
Yes.
It doesn't seem to be repeated as a direct command in the New Testament.
It's not, that's
what,
right.
What do we do with the Sabbath? It seems to be an unusual one that it's more difficult to deal with.
Yes, I guess one reason I'm not a Presbyterian is because I disagree with the Presbyterian interpretation of the Sabbath. I think the only clue about the Sabbath in the New Testament is the clues in Hebrews about the Sabbath pointing to our Sabbath rest, the Sabbath rest of the people of God. So I think the instruction about the Sabbath should be rightly understood as enjoying salvation through Christ, our great high priest. As there's a balance, I think, or an equivalent in Hebrews about the land. We often think of the Old Testament folk as worrying about real estate all the time, but Hebrews 11 makes it clear that they saw the land as merely a sign of something better to come, and that is the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. So as the Sabbath points to the rest of the people, the rest of the people of God, not in the land but with God, so I think the land points beyond itself to the eternal city, Jerusalem.
Is there any practical application of that for us as Christians today, and to look forward to heaven every day?
It is,
not just once a week.
That's exactly right. And I think it's very revealing to discover that Old Testament saints were doing that. We read about them and think they're just concerned about getting into the land. In fact, the writer of Hebrews makes it clear there's something else which is their focus. But I must say, living in our society, it's almost impossible to be focused on anything other than this world. Our society tells us this is all there is. And despite lots of encouragement from the New Testament, I personally find it difficult to focus on the life to come, or you know, the new heaven and the new earth, or whatever it is. And I must confess that I've lived a lot of my Christian life thinking I don't need that sense of reward, which was, I now think, absolutely stupid, because it's there in the New Testament. God provided it for me. Yeah. How arrogant of me to think I don't need it. So in the last 3 years, I've been trying to focus more on both the warning of judgment to come and also the better, the new heaven and the new earth experience with God in the future. And I think that's been good for me, actually.
Mm. Well, listeners to this interview will be interested to know that we have four talks by Peter Jensen on the role of the law and the Ten Commandments in the life of a Christian elsewhere on The Theologian. Hopefully they'll click on those and find some other material to follow that up. Peter, as Principal of the Theological College there in Melbourne, you're supervising the PhD of a guy called Andrew Malone, who's written some excellent articles for The Theologian on this whole subject of Christ in the Old Testament. And, of course, the Blackham-Goldsworthy debate on that subject is on The Theologian. Is this a big issue in Australia about Christ in the Old Testament, Christophanies? Do people read too much back into the Old Testament?
Yeah, it's a great issue, and I think Andrew Malone's doing an excellent job. He writes very well, and when he finishes his doctorate, and I hope he'll publish it, it'll be a very useful resource. Mm. I think I might be guilty of actually promoting the questions in Andrew's mind. I remember when I lectured in Hebrews a number of years ago at Ridley, just as a visiting lecturer, I did take people through Calvin's theology of the one covenant. Mm. And Calvin has a very strong theology that Christ is the mediator of all the knowledge of God. Therefore, every time a prophet speaks, Christ is speaking through the prophet. So according to Calvin in the Old Testament, Christ speaks through the prophet, reigns through the kings, and forgives through the priest, if I can put it that way. Mm. So that leads you to expect to find Christ on every second page of the Old Testament. Quite a busy life, really. Andrew's done some useful work on that idea of Christ the mediator, I suspect. And of course it's theologically true that Christ mediates the knowledge of God. There's one God and one mediator. The question then is how that's expressed in the Old Testament. It's useful to point out, of course, necessary to point out, that the God of the Old Testament is not God the Father, full stop. The God of the Old Testament is God the Trinity, though not named as such, because there's no other God. It's not that there was a father and then between Malachi and Matthew the Son was produced and then later on they thought up the Holy Spirit. The God of the Old Testament is the Trinity. The question is God, there are two questions, is God revealed as Trinity in any aspect, and then is God recognized as Trinity in the Old Testament? Well, I want to answer those questions because that's Andrew Malone's job. But one thing which really intrigues me is to contrast the way Paul talks in 1 Corinthians 10 about Christ in the Old Testament and the way the Lord Jesus talks about the manna in John chapter 6. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, Paul says, they drank of that rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. Well, that looks to me as if he's saying Christ was present as they drank of the supernatural water, the miraculous water from the rock. They not only experienced physical relief from physical thirst, but also in some way they experienced life, the life of Christ. That seems to me an obvious way of reading it. So there in 1 Corinthians 10, Paul is saying Christ was present in the water, or the rock was Christ, the rock that produced the water was Christ. However, in John chapter 6, Jesus contrasts the bread that Moses gave their forefathers with himself as the living bread come down from heaven for the life of the world, and the bread which I will give for the life of the world is my flesh. So he does a contrast between the bread and himself, whereas Paul does an equivalence between the rock which produced the water and Christ. Now, that's a notable problem for some bright young theologian to sort out, I suspect. But what I suspect will be the answer is that both are true. That is, in some sense, saints of the Old Testament experience some benefits of the New Testament in a shadowy kind of way, but they don't experience it as fully as New Testament believers do. And Hebrews, of course, makes that point at the end of chapter 11, beginning of chapter 12, that these all died in faith, not having received the promise. Well, in a way, they had received part of the promise, but not the fullness of the promise. So I suspect the theological resolution lies in that kind of area, that they did experience God, but not as fully as New Testament believers experience God. And Jesus makes a similar point in John 7 about the Spirit. This he said about the Spirit was not yet given because Jesus was not yet glorified. The Spirit is around in the Old Testament, but not as fully as the Spirit is around in the New Testament. So in a way, it's the bigger question. The bigger question is, what is the Old Testament saints' experience of God, and how does it relate to the New Testament saints and our experience of God?
Excellent. That's pretty helpful. We'll hopefully be able to chase up some of those ideas in future articles and interviews on The Theologian. Peter, one thing you seem to have done really well in your whole career is to be an integrated theologian. That's something that The Theologian is all about, integrating the Bible with doctrine, church history and pastoral studies, with a master's degree in New Testament and PhD in systematics and all the things you've written on various other subjects. But I wonder, what is the advantage of having been a pastor for 20 years? Is that just wasted time in your development as a theologian to have been in a backwater of pastoral ministry at St. Jude's, Carlton for so long?
Yeah, well, I finished my PhD and very soon after that moved to ministry at St. Jude's, Carlton. I remember thinking midway through that ministry that I was using the skills that I'd learnt in doing my PhD every day in my ministry. So that was a marvellous experience of integration, actually, that all the things I'd learnt doing a PhD I was using every day. That isn't the question you asked, but I thought I'd say it anyway.
What sort of skills do you mean that you're using every day?
Trying to think about theological implications and connections between Christology and the doctrine of the church, doctrine of humanity and so on. So able to make those connections, able to see that theology has implications. So every theological statement can be expressed in practical terms. Sorry, by the way, when I teach theology at Ridley, this may help, most people who teach theology teach historical theology, that is the history of Christian thought, and or systematic theology, that is the integration of theological thought, the system. I add two things to that. One is biblical theology at one end. So I always make sure that we start with the Bible, though it isn't a recognized textbook for theology. I think it probably has some relevance. And then I always do a practical theology thing at the end. So if we believed this, what would it look like in practice? And that's a useful skill to teach ministers, I think, and church workers, because eventually they can look at a practice and ask the question, what theology is implied by this practice, which is a useful way of critiquing practice. Or they can look at a theology and say, now how can we put this into practice? So it was a very simple example. A friend of mine went to preach at a church and there was no Bible reading. That's a very profound theological statement, actually.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Or if you let the youth group organise a service, they will always leave out the confession of sin. And if you go to a church, you will often find the intercessions are about the needs of the church, family, full stop. They don't pray for the world or don't pray for Christian mission or something like that. Mm-hmm. All those are really revealing practices, in my opinion. Or I visit families, and it's amazing how often it's the wife who says, well, I think we'll say grace. And that says something very powerful about their practice of family life, in my opinion. And in my opinion, says something very powerful about the fact that husbands and fathers aren't taking a lead in promoting Christian practice in the family. Well, here's another practice which I think is very revealing. I often ask couples, how's your marriage going? And the wife always says, we do have a few things to work through. The husband always says, things are fine. And I think to myself, well, a husband ought to read Ephesians 5 and find out that actually he's got great responsibility for the welfare of his marriage and the welfare of his wife. Mm. Sorry, we're away from the subject. What I'm saying is you can go from practice to theology as easily as you can go from theology to practice.
Yeah. So you learned that in your PhD.
I think I did, actually, because it was on the imitation of Christ. And the imitation of Christ is about what people do, but it was a theological study of the imitation of Christ. So what theology lies behind this practice of the imitation of Christ? So it was a very useful way into the topic, actually.
And then being at St. Jude's was 20 years of experience in putting that into practice and seeing it illustrated in front of you.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And, I mean, it makes sense. Otherwise, why do people study theology at college if it's not going to be useful? People think, well, it may be useful if people ask me a theological question. But no, it has a far broader use than that, in my opinion. Yeah.
So you're hoping to produce theologians out of Ridley College or pastors?
Our aim is to produce pastors, ministers, evangelists, church planters, missionaries, youth workers, school chaplains. But fundamentally, those who are able to use the Bible well, that's the first thing, who lead godly lives and are trained in ministry. But part of that, I think, they need theology, they need a theological awareness to read the Bible and to do their ministry. You can't read the Bible without theology. And so they need some theological awareness to make sense of the Bible and or then to make sense of their ministry. Somebody asked me a question today, actually, at the conference about, was there a good book on application of texts? So you're preaching on Malachi chapter 1. How do you apply it? Well, that's actually a theological question. And if you haven't done any theology, you'll have no idea how to apply Malachi chapter 1. Or if you do, you'll get it wrong. So,
and what book did you say?
I said there isn't one.
There isn't one?
Yeah. I don't think there is a book on application. Yeah.
Are you going to write it?
Well, I thought to myself, perhaps I should encourage somebody else to write it.
Maybe someone listening to this interview
will take up
the challenge.
That's right. God has spoken.
Let's hope
so.
Let's hope so. Well, let's talk just briefly about your books. I mentioned three books that you've published at the beginning. Tell us first about your commentary on Hebrews, The Majestic Son. How did this come about?
When I went to St. Jude's, it was a church which was used to systematic Bible teaching, book by book and stuff like that. And so one of the series I did was on Hebrews. I preached on Hebrews over 9 months. That is three-month segments on Hebrews. Unlike the Reverend William Googe, who preached at St. Anne's Blackfriars in the 17th century for 36 years on Hebrews, non-stop, and then published his sermons for those who were born too late to hear the first lot. So 9 months was pretty easy, really. And then Paul Barnett, I think, who edits the series, must have said, learnt about the series and asked me to write the commentary, which I did. It's the kind of commentary I enjoy writing. I enjoy writing the commentary at a level which helps ordinary people read a difficult book and discover they can make sense of it. I really enjoy that. I love that, yeah.
It's clear in that book you've done quite a lot of hard work in the commentaries and in the Greek and that sort of thing, but it's not an overly technical commentary.
No, not at all.
So you wear your learning and your hard work very lightly in there for the benefit of the reader.
That's the idea, yeah, because that's where Bible knowledge becomes useful. Commentators write commentaries for other writers of commentaries, but the point of the Bible is it's actually for the church. So anything which can help that to happen is good. I think one of the things we did at St. Jude's was to try and sometimes to coordinate Bible studies with the sermon series. So often I was writing studies for study groups. Two ways of doing that. You can either get people to study the passage the week before and then preach on it, or else you do the Bible studies for them to use the week after the sermon, so that focuses more on application of how, you know, here's what the text means, let's talk about how to apply it. Both are useful, I think, and I think the commentary on Hebrews probably includes a bit of both, actually.
Well, that leads us nicely on to your second book, which I mentioned, about speaking God's words, A Practical Theology of Preaching. Is that just something that arose out of your thinking about what you were doing week in and week out at St. Jude's, or was there another genesis to that project?
I was thinking about preaching quite a lot. Anybody who preaches a lot must think about preaching, presumably. Peter Jensen, who was then the principal of Moore College, invited me to give the Moore College lectures, I think in 1986. And I realised when I looked at books on preaching that there were many books on the practice of preaching, the kind of practical issues about preaching, but there wasn't actually a book that I could find at the time which was a theology of preaching. So here's how to preach. For me, the question was, why preach? Because lots of people, it seemed to me, in the church generally were losing confidence in preaching. So if you're going to lose confidence in preaching, you need a book which tackles the theology of preaching, not just the practice of preaching. But I wanted it to be a book in which people could see the practical implications of the theology as well. Mm. So I really enjoyed working on that, and I'm very grateful to Peter Jensen and the Moore College folk for encouraging me to write that. And I think the book is good in parts, and I think people have benefited from some parts of the book. Yeah. So I'm pleased to have done that. Yeah.
The other book I mentioned is Hearing God's Words. Now, that isn't just sort of addressed to the people who hear the sermons week in and week out, is it? So we have the preaching God's words, and here's another book for those who are listening week in and week out. Or is it more than that?
I've been interested in the subject of spirituality for a number of years. That was partly given to me by Harry Scott Simmons, who'd inherited from Amy Carmichael a great interest in Raymond Lull and some of the Dutch movements of spirituality, so A Kempis's Imitation of Christ, things like that. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't suspicious of that. I actually took that on as a good thing. And of course, in the evangelical world which I was brought up in the 60s and 70s, people were still profoundly affected by missionary biographies. They were a way in which evangelicals communicated spirituality very powerfully. So what model of Christian life was appropriate? The answer was, well, you read By Searching or Hudson Taylor, and that was the ideal Christian life. So that was a very practical way in which evangelicals communicated spirituality, though they perhaps didn't realise that's what they were doing. But, I mean, the rules about quiet times and daily prayer, that's all about spirituality, I think. But I was also aware of the issue that I mentioned a little while ago, that the common theory around was that evangelicals were good on basic Bible, but to be spiritually mature, you had to either become a liberal or go to Catholic spirituality or become a charismatic and enjoy that spirituality. So in terms of the internal life of the church, I wanted to say we believe in the sufficiency of Scripture. If it's sufficient for the way of salvation, it's also sufficient for spirituality. So that was an attempt to put a theology into practice within the evangelical movement in the church. And I was also aware, just going down to secular bookshops in Australia, that there were large spirituality sections which had everything but a Bible in them and included every spirituality from Aztec to Zoroastrian, and people regarded as fairly chic to adopt, you know, some exotic spirituality or something like that. Mm-hmm. I remember actually there was a BBC series called The Long Search, in which Ronald Ayres gave the kind of presentation, and that was a very very attractive and graphic study of the religions of the world. And the theory was that, you know, the more exotic the religion was, the more interested the BBC were in it, which I think indicates a certain superficiality of judgment. It was a great series because it ended in Ronald Ayres' London flat. And he said to the camera, of course, we've looked at all these spiritualities. The question is, which is the right one? And then what are we going to do about it? Then there was silence. Then he moved to his kitchen, made a cup of tea. And I thought, what a quintessentially British way of dealing with the great problems of life. Have a nice cup of tea and sit down and don't worry about it. But if people in the world are interested in spirituality, then we ought to be talking about spirituality. And I was sick of hearing people say to meditate is to empty your mind, when it was very clear the Bible said to meditate is to fill your mind with the words of God and the works of God. So, it again, I think it's not a very well-written book, but it was trying to make some of those points, I guess, and point people in a direction.
Yeah. Is there anything else in the pipeline that you can tell us about? Any other books?
Yes, like I'm trying to write a book on what the Bible teaches about the Bible, because lots of evangelical books tell you what the Bible must be, It must be a clear book, an authoritative book, because we need that. But they don't often begin from the Bible itself, yet presumably that's where we ought to get our doctrine of the Bible from, the Bible itself.
Is this in a series, an existing series? Or
no, it's going to be a one-off, I think. And I've done the first draft, and I'm going to work on it more of it later this year. It's a very interesting thing to write, because at first glance, the answer is nothing. That is, the Bible doesn't ever, in particular verse, describe itself as a complete set of 66 books, if you like. Mm. So it could be a very short book. What's the Bible teach about the Bible? Nothing.
The end.
The end.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping to do perhaps spin it out a bit more than that. And I found it, I did a lot of work on it last year, and I found it tremendously encouraging.
Working title? What the Bible says about the Bible.
Bible, yes. It might be receiving God's words. I'm thinking of copywriting the phrase God's words.
It does appear in several things.
It does.
Already, yeah.
So, you know, I could have hearing God's words, speaking God's words, receiving God's words, putting God's words to music, half remembering God's words, misquoting God's words. I mean, you know, there's a 12-volume series there already, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm sure IVP would love to take it up.
They'd be hammering at the door, I think. That's right.
Tell us finally then, Peter, about George. George the poodle.
Oh, the poodle. Yes, exactly right. Yeah. Well, we had when I was young, we had poodles, and they're great house dogs because they don't shed hair. They're good for people with allergies because they don't have doggy hair things in them, and they're meant to be reasonably intelligent. My first dog, Poppy, was a black poodle, and she was very bright. I got a second hand, and she was a very nice dog. She was very discerning about preaching, actually.
Really?
Yeah. On one occasion, I went to Ridley to take the preaching class, and that meant that one of the students preached their first sermon, and then the class was meant to give a gentle critique of the sermon. Well, I forget who the student was, fortunately, but this student preached a sermon which wasn't terribly good, and there was that long, awful pause in which nobody can quite think what to say. Poppy, who'd come along to the lecture, then stood up, moved to the centre of the room, and vomited loudly. You know, you can vomit quietly, but discreetly into the handkerchief, but this was a loud public vomit. Reminded me of one of the stories of Thomas Beecham about when an elephant defecated on the stage during the performance of Aida. Anyway, this shows what a discerning dog Poppy was. Anyway, Poppy went to her reward, whatever that was. And I inherited George, who'd been dumped by his previous owner. Now, the thing about poodles is the clever ones are black. That's the basic colour for poodles. And when they breed to get a different colour, they lose out on the brains, I'm afraid. So George is a brainless apricot poodle. I remember when he first arrived, he was sitting next to a heater, and his back end was on fire. George just sat there looking quite unconcerned, wasn't even worried, you know, shows how stupid he is. And if you hit him on the head, there's a real sort of empty clunking sound. But because he's brainless, he makes a great companion and very popular around the college. Yeah, I'd like to point out, by the way, that if you ask the question, I hope you will, Lee, what dog did David Livingstone take to Africa to protect him on his journeys across Africa? The answer is a poodle.
No.
Yes.
Not a chihuahua.
Not a chihuahua. A big standard poodle.
Well, that just shows that you and David Livingstone have much in common.
Exactly right.
Both great
men. Mission biographies, you know, they have a profound effect on me.
Well, we look forward to reading a biography of Dr. Peter Adam and his George the Poodle at some point. Thanks very much for speaking to us this afternoon.
Yes, pleasure.
It's been great. And thank you to James Taylor, our audio sub-editor, for all his help with the technical stuff. Do look at www.theologian.org.uk for more interviews, MP3s, and interesting articles on many different theological and practical subjects.